This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Kevin was born in Wigan in northwest England and joined the RAF as an apprentice in 1956 with only three O-levels. He came top of his course and was posted into supplies at RAF St Morgan. However, he quickly became in charge of their clothing stores and via a fortuitous route became a trainee pilot. In May 1963, he joined the RAF V Force as a Vulcan pilot and served with 44 Squadron, where Vulcan crews were being converted to low-level flying. He describes the challenges of low-level flying, Vulcan handling, and the immense power of the Vulcan's engines. He also describes his training in Canada. Kevin tells us about the different methods of nuclear bomb release, what it was like to be on the quick reaction nuclear alert, and his targets in the Soviet Union. Kevin also flew a number of the Queen's birthday flights up the Mall in London, and he describes a near collision on one of these events in Cloud. We also remember his colleagues, who never came back from their missions. I'm delighted to welcome Kevin to our Cold War conversation.
I'm a Wigan grammar school boy who didn't get on well at school because I was lazy. I never went to school. And I had a difficult home because my mother was, somewhat resentful. So I looked for the opportunity to leave. I was brought up by my grandmother, who had nine children, well, including me, she looked after nine. She had eight children, including my mother, and then I was just looked after. My mother was out working in the armament factories and around, I got three O-levels. Subsequently, I've looked at it, and you were eligible. I was, with the three O-levels, to be a pilot in the RAF. The only drawback was I was 16. You had to be 17 and a half.
So on the 26th of January 1956, Kevin joined the RAF as an apprentice. This was part of a scheme created in 1920 by Lord Trenchard, who was then chief of the Air Staff and approved by Winston Churchill.
And it changed my life. I mean, it was the best things that ever happened. I revised all my education in the Air Force, all the GCs I'd done and not attended. And I was a few months older than the average, and I was a good rugby player. In fact, that was one of the drawbacks of being a good rugby player, because they were short of a scrum half. And I'm not really a scrum half, but I could do it. And they'd lost the courses, the previous course had left, and they were short, and they had bullying in these services, which I spent most of my life trying to stop one way or another, because I really despise the way that people are treated by other people for fun. But they came and turned all over the beds. We lived in barrack huts, and the only beds still standing were mine, because I was in the rugby team.
After passing his apprenticeship, Kevin is faced with some disappointment.
And I was top of my course, and I was the parade, you know, captain of the school, whatever else. Badge, you know, show you the pictures. And I was turned down as a pilot, but I was offered a opportunity to be an RAF regiment.
Rock ape.
Actually, there was a word academic risk thrown in somewhere. There was an academic risk, but they'd have me as a rock ape.
The nickname rock ape originates from an incident in 1952. Two RAF regiment officers serving in Aden decided to amuse themselves by going out to shoot some Hamadryas baboons, locally referred to as rock apes. In this semi-darkness, one of the officers fired at a moving object in the distance. When he reached the target, he discovered he'd shot and wounded the other officer, and when asked at a board of inquiry why he had fired at his friend, the officer replied his target had looked just like a rock ape in the half light. The remark soon reverberated around the RAF, and it was not long before the term was in general use.
For the rest of my life, I've never failed an exam in the RAF. I've been on courses with group captains. I've been on courses, staff college, and I've always managed to come top. So somebody somewhere was kicking me up the bum. But I went to a job as a supplier. I was a corporal supplier one at RAF St Morgan. And the senior equipment officer had been burned badly in his Lancaster. My job was nailing up the Lancaster spares and sending them back. The RAF had air quartermasters, loadmasters, they call them. And if you were a supplier, one, I was, because I'd done a course, I was eligible to be automatically. So they made me a sergeant supplier, 19 years old. Seriously. It's resented by the adjutant of 99 Squadron, where I was based. And there we were, sergeant, 19-year-old Kevin. And that's when I got married. I commuted from St Morgan to Wigan via the replenishment aircraft that brought in spares at the weekend on a Friday. This young equipment officer generously said, off you go, Kevin. I played rugby again at the weekend times if I wasn't going up there. But I went up to Shrewsbury, to Shawbury, where my wife, who's not with us now, lived 8 miles down the road. And then I hitchhiked from St Morgan up the Murrupsey-Dupsey to Wigan and had 2 nights at home with this lady who became my wife. The war was on in Egypt, Suez. Yeah.
The 1956 Suez crisis was caused by Britain, along with France and Israel, invading Egypt to recover control of the Suez Canal. Domestically, it caused massive political fallout in Britain and resulted in an economic crisis. Internationally, it further complicated the politics of the Middle East, threatening Britain's key diplomatic relationships with Commonwealth nations and the United States-United Kingdom special relationship, as the US hadn't been given prior notice of the invasion.
And they nicked everybody who was anybody, he'd been around and did it, and they took him away. And there was I, junior technician, in charge of the clothing stores. Oh, I could tell you how to make a fortune. I got on very well with the tailor. And all these aircrew who'd been in the war were retiring and bringing back their equipment. And I was just quite clever at making sure they left with a smile on their face, because who wants to use their old gloves? Who wants to use their old things? But the RAF might, but I had a way of being able to get rid of that. No. So I was in charge of the clothing stores for a period of this time because of this Egypt war. And then I say these two fellows, the two officers there, were just so good to me. They took me in. I mean, I was only 19, and it still was quite young, you know, to be having these stripes. I learned at the technique. There was one corporal in charge there when I came, and he was walking around with a file under his arm. And I said, "What are you doing, corporal?" He said, "I'm walking around with a file under my arm."
Looking busy.
Yeah. This quartermaster thing came up. And so I was sent, did some training, and they said, "No, we're not going to give you the training because we've got some passenger airplanes and you're going to be a steward on a passenger airplane." The Britannia airplane, the 252 Britannia, that cardboard floor, you know, take anything, take your boots off almost, and up and down doing training for the crews and route proving, because we used to stop everywhere. In fact, I just took a jacket off a coat hanger in my spare room yesterday. KLM Karachi. I don't make it up. I'll tell you, go and have a look. That was it. The RAF just put me in an aeroplane, and they said, a boy from Wigan, 19, and then they said, "We do the course, the Hastings course, to convert you to the Britannia. Takes place at Dishforth." And so we went to Dishforth in the winter. And it was crappy. So they said, "Well, we're off. We're going to Idris. Idris? Oh, that was a lemonade. No, Idris. King Idris was in charge of Libya. And we went to King Idris's airport and did the whole course out there flying across the desert. Just sitting in, and I learned about duty-free booze.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Was that the first time you'd been outside?
I'd never been outside Britain. So I joined 99 Squadron and flew up and down with the Britannia for about 9 months and sat on the navigator's desk. And a very nice chap. He was the adjutant who resented me being a sergeant. And then I went through the system and went to South Cerny. And that's where I met my boss man. And I said, I really wanted to be a pilot. But he said, well, that's quite a big decision, you know. And he phoned him up.
Kevin has to undergo some aptitude tests.
And then the next thing I knew, they crossed off navigator and they put pilot. Yeah, so then I say that, and from Piston Provost, they'll go to Vampires at Swinderby. 6 months on Vampires, and I can still see, if I close my eyes, my first solo going over Newark. It's amazing what's up there.
And in May 1963, Kevin joins the V-Force as a Vulcan pilot.
And the Vulcan I went to was the 44 Squadron. The reason I went to 44 Squadron was because I was fourth in the batting order of finishing the course out of 21 people. I was number four. And they had two CFS and one Canberra appointment. And then the next thing was all of them went to V-Force aircraft. And I had the first choice. And I didn't want to go wearing a G suit, altitude flying, blue steel.
The Blue Steel missile was a British air-launched, rocket-propelled, nuclear-armed standoff missile. Built to arm the V-Bomber Force, it allowed the bomber to launch a missile against its target while still outside the range of service-to-air missiles.
And the 44 Squadron was starting up as a low-level squadron, so I'll go there. And I joined a squadron and a crew, so I didn't go through the training process. As a crew, I went through with as a sort of odd bod, which is not a great way to start. But I replaced a bloke who was being promoted to captain. So he was sent off to do his captain's course, and then he flew on another squadron as a captain. I only knew him briefly, but he became quite famous by crashing a Vulcan into the Black Mountains. He finished his tour. He was going to CFS instructor course, but he didn't make it. So there I was, a Sprog co-pilot on 44 Squadron for 2.5 years. And in that time, that's when my wife went home, the baby died. I obviously wasn't. I remember one of my bosses, I can't remember which one, you know, is talking about, and they didn't use the word grief in those days. So they sent me to CFS.
Flying for the V-Force wasn't Kevin's first choice.
If I wanted to be a fighter pilot, I want to be on my own. And bloody Vulcan and nuclear bombs and flying once a week. And when you get good enough, when you've qualified, you don't fly anymore. You know, you've got this target of time. I didn't know that amount of knowledge. Yeah, I flew with a wing commander who now became an Air Vice Marshal. And I can remember a conversation, the first time we flew, and I'm sitting in the right-hand seat watching this this wing commander flying in. He'd been at a desk for quite a long time. And the instructors between us, because there's only two seats at the front. And he says, yeah, that's fine, but you're a bit close. And he said, from which end? the group captain became. Well, he became the group captain at Waddington and then an air marshal. Iceland. But shall I get my logbook just to give it?
Love to see it.
I'd like to. You only opened it twice. Yeah. There's not a lot of Vulcan stuff because you do so little flying. Yeah, here we go. Vampires. A tidy writer I was, I can read it. Bryce was the instructor, and John Stacey was the wing commander.
John describes the experience of flying a Vulcan.
It's a lot of power. I never flew a Mark II Vulcan at full power. They had they were built to carry, the engines were built, the Olympus 301s were built to carry the Skybolt, and it never came. So when you did the checklist for the engine control, it was wire locked on. Now I know there are people who used to unlock it. Sure, you know, it's your engine, I not my engine. But it was quite a thrust, but it was a heavy airplane, and we'd take off with full fuel tanks every time we would take off, except on a display, which I did a few displays, and I did some flypasts. You know, the Queen's birthday, I used to go on that, did a couple of those. But yeah, no, the takeoff of the Vulcan, the thing is, you pitch up and you rotate, and you can pull and pull and pull and stand it on its tail, and it will just keep going up. And I did it, and we diverted from Goose Bay into one of the, well, into the States, one of the air bases up there. They said, well, you've got to go back to Goose, where you got no fuel on, hardly. And the cold as wet, and I took off, and I did this fucking climb, and I went, like, really vertical for that time. And say to about 10,000 feet. And then in my case, went into the bloody cloud, didn't we? And I go, I'll get it all over. But on a different occasion, Bonin Barksdale, one of the pilots, did the similar thing. And I used to say this, that I could feel the pain in my thighs from being clenched up watching him take off, because they were loaded down with booze and charcoal, briquettes we'd buy in the beach. The aeroplane was overloaded, and he tried the same thing. And I thought he was going to crash. You know, I really thought it would crash. What we used to do with three-engine takeoff, well, when you were an instructor on type, you had to demonstrate the loss of an engine. So you had the scramble, and there's four of you going, and they've got to say, well, there's a chance of one in four might lose an engine. And so you've got to keep going. And that's interesting to watch some of the blokes trying to cope with it.
Because you're then out of balance. Totally
out of balance with two times the thrust on one side, and you've got to have your leg ready to keep it in the middle, or keep your little thumb on the button for the steering. I think they might have stopped doing it, because quite a lot of exercises in aviation were practiced, and then people realised that there were more people being killed with the practice, certainly asymmetric flying on the Meteors, for example, than were ever going to happen of losing an engine. But that's growing up in aviation.
What's it like flying at low level in a Vulcan?
I'll tell you another little story then. So I did my first trip to Goose Bay with Wally Wallbank on January the 12th, 1965. And so it's an early experience for me. And I'm looking out, and we're flying over the simulating bombing attacks in Russia. And I've always been told that these trees were quite tall, about 3 feet tall. And I didn't realize, I just saw this visual picture. And I was flying, but it's level. And I've only been with them a month. And the navigators were very, very tolerant. I didn't put the navigators' names in because I used to put crew. I regret doing that. And there's a radio altimeter, and it's a red, green, and yellow, you know, traffic lights. And they were always red, and I put the thing in as unserviceable. You're going to fault in the altimeters, they're not reading. No. Said we had no horizon for the whole of the bloody trip. But if you've got visibility, as in Canada, in when the clear weather, you know, you can see forever. Not that there's a lot to see. But it's a challenge. They do it up the Lake District. And I was also a TFR training officer. There's something else to put a badge on. Do you know what that sounds like? No, you don't. TFR, train following radar trainer. So you had to sit there while some bloke practiced. Because there's inertia, and the airplane has got a lot of inertia, and it's not as responsive. I mean, I think it's a magnificent machine for its era. It wasn't my idea of fun doing TFR at night, and there's no point in doing it in the daylight if you can see, and if you can't see, you shouldn't be there, because that's what people do, and more than one. We've lost a few off these aeroplanes.
Kevin describes the bomb release methods.
At least three methods. When I started them, they did this pop-up. They used to, but before that, it was at high altitude. Before they would do an S-turn, and it had a name, and you'd pull one down and then the other way, and then they'd let it go, and it would throw it away, and you'd be zooming off. But for the low-level one, you had to, it had to have 10,000 feet for the release of the weapon. So you come along, woozing along, and then up, and then a wing over and away. But by the time I was back on the Mark II Vulcan, it was a lay-down parachute job, and it weighed 1,000 pounds. It was a 1,000-pounder. I couldn't believe it, because the first bomb that I saw, Red Sun, was like a 10-ton World War II bomb. With just the nuclear end stuck in, and it, you know, fell out of the Lancaster or whatever. This how it started, the YS-2, Yellow Sun, and then it became this thing. I don't know, but they gave it a name. But the more interesting ones were when you were at 40,000 feet and you were doing these S turns, because you're right on the edge, especially if you've got a long trip to come. The lay down, you just zoom through. You were never going to get away. That's what this wing commander, AEO, would say, that you're flying down there. It's a one-way trip. I'm not coming home, so don't worry about me.
Is what he's saying there, you wouldn't have escaped the blast?
I don't. Well, the people doubt. I mean, we don't know the strength of those particular weapons. They had this multiple time of the Hiroshima bomb. Yep.
Kevin describes QRA, or quick reaction alerts. This is a 24 hours a day, 7 days a week state of alert, with crews ready to launch a nuclear mission at any time.
QRA starts at 15 minutes. So you're in, you're near, but you're 15 minutes. You're to be in the cockpit with the engines running.
Right.
So you get the bomber controller, and he calls you. This is the bomber controller for such force only, and readiness 1-5. And off you go. At 1-5, you get in the cockpit. And then they bring you up to, and you can take off. I've taken off on it. And then you end up somewhere too, like one of the dispersal airfields, because that's the whole point of the, get them off the ground so they're not all in one big hump. Yeah, 15 minutes you were in the aeroplane, 15 minutes. Otherwise you were...
And then if you get the call to go,
yeah,
you assume it's an exercise.
I think everybody did, yes.
Until you get the radio message to say...
Yeah, I think everybody assumed it.
How was the command given for you to release the nuclear bomb?
Well, that was done with codes through command headquarters.
Right.
And there were two lock. You compared, you open your safe on board even. And if the numbers apply, then somebody's got to press a button. And you drilled it every time you flew. You had it checked, the bomb release safety lock, and then off it would go. I don't think anyone ever thought, in my experience, that they'd ever have to set one off.
So the bomb release lock, that's controlled by the captain.
Yeah, he's got that. Yeah,
and then
right.
Do you pass control to the nav radar?
No, the nav radar finds the target and he then presses his release. But you've got to
release the release to him.
Yeah, to release,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a bomb release safety.
And is that's like a verbal, you say, right, you now have control.
Yeah, that's right.
Is there a certain form of words that you would say to the nav radar?
Yeah, that's it. But to say that is one of the memories of I've no real thought of that. But we do all these drills. And
you're on QRA, and was there any time where you were scrambled and you didn't know whether it was a test or whether it was?
You just hoped it wasn't. You know, one of the real reasons I was not in my bed for more than half the year was that we had so many bosses. You had the group captain who'd run the station and have a station exercise. And there were a thing called the tachyval, and that would go by group headquarters. And then we got included into the maritime elements because they used the nuclear. We used to go for ships. And so we had so many bloody bosses, and they could each pull one of their things. It was a pain in the arse. You know, you never knew, what was happening. So you would assume that it was a drill because...
But it could have been...
It could have been for real,
Until you got a...
Well,
recall.
Until you got your code, it was fairly safe. I thought you were going to ask about if you got stood down. I've had people refusing to get out because they haven't received the stand-down code. And they think, it's me. No, I don't. And they're there with an aeroplane ticking away, and they won't take any notice of the instruction because it's not been to the letter.
So I just want to understand how that QRA scramble works. Yeah. So you are told go.
Yes.
And when you're airborne, are you sent a message to say keep going or return?
But before you went, you would know where you were going.
Right.
Because you would be... each week you had a requirement for target study. I think I've read someone left the Air Force and didn't want to do it because he met a girl somewhere, you know, in a foreign land where he was... And when they were chatting, he said she was in the town where he was his target. I mean, I know a lot of Russian places because that's all we had, and there were places where you would go to land, and you knew you couldn't come back to Waddington because you ain't got any fuel. There's no refueling on the way. And that's why it was a one-way thing. But we, as I say, as a combat survival officer, we would have our boots that we could walk, turn into shoes, and we'd hide behind bushes. I don't know.
What were your targets? What cities were
they? Varied mainly. They were military or factories. You didn't know sometimes because you just got a route into a town or an area, because although we used to have bombing competitions where they could the bombing accuracies were amazingly from 40,000 feet on these competitions, and they'd get them, you know, with bullseye. But it didn't matter. It did not matter the low level delivery was definitely the best way out in my opinion, because there is a protection from the ground, or there was anyway. If you were doing it. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. Yeah. And can you remember any of the cities?
No, I could. You know, John, I have not committed any. My memory just isn't good enough. Yeah. We tended to use use it as a rest hour or two. You go into sign into the center because you had to sign for all your documents and carry them in there, and no one else was allowed in there, so you could play cards if you wanted to, and I'm sure people did. But you know, I've been meticulously. I do what I have to do, but you can get feel that it's a bit pointless. This because I ain't ever going to do this. If I looked at a map, I could pick a name, but I say, well, I know that because that's that river up there, and the whole load of the navigators themselves, and you had two navigators, the bomber, but. They're equally trained, and he would tell you what you're doing. That's your place. Map. You might have to map read. Khaki, yes, that's a long time ago. That.
Did you discuss with the crew what you were going to do after the bomb was released? Like where you were going to go?
Well, no, you had a route. Oh, yeah, yeah.
After. So you did yes. you have a route?
Yeah, but after
oh, yeah. released the bomb.
That's one of the things. Mostly, I should think entirely. Your subsequent destination after you drop the bomb would be somewhere in Turkey, probably, if you're going into Russia. Mm-hmm. But it would be specified in your routing.
Okay.
And off you'd go. So I know a lot of places of names in Turkey, because with... Britannia never went to Turkey when I was working for them. And then they started, right at the end of my time, they started having holidays in these places. And I thought, oh, I've heard that. Where's that? And it was one of the recovery airports. Yeah. So I hope they're friendly. Yeah. And if it's a one-way ticket, you may well choose not to go to an airfield. You may well slide it down on on a lake.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody has ever... Has anyone ditched one of these things? I'm not sure.
Well, only in the Thunderball, the James Bond film. Have you ever watched that?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that I talked about this the other day because I'm clearing stuff out there that's full of films of various sorts. And I watched a film, and it was Thunderball came up, and the chap standing at the bottom of the ladder. Is an old mate of mine, and I can't think of his name. We were really good friends, and the question I was asking was: every time anybody watches one, does he get a loyalty thing? Because he just stands at the bottom. Yeah. The pilot was Albert Wallace, who is the guy who I flew with here. He did the flying over the sea, and then there's I got a photograph of me standing at the. You don't want to see a photograph of me standing at the bottom of the ladder of a Vulcan. Just not a very. They send them photographs off for a promotional advertising for the. And it was the Queen's birthday day, because the date's on the back second of June. So these flypasts, the Queen's flypasts, there'd be probably six or seven rehearsals. And one. Year they gave the job to the pilots of the instructors at from Finningley, the OCU. But the year before and the year after that, they gave it to my squadron, Scott Iverson. And so you're hard to believe this, but the briefing was being given in Waddington, and Eric asked a question. What will you do if you get IMC, That's a simple question. I certainly know it was a good question. And this bloke, squadron leader, said, well, we'll deal with that. And he bloody didn't, because on the day we actually went, on that day, we went into cloud. And I'm the number four.
So IMC is?
In cloud, India, right, my okay. instrument meteorological condition, sorry.
Right, okay.
And I'm at the back, and there are four Vulcans, and then they hang the lightnings or whatever else is hanging on them. But the backbone of these four aeroplanes. And this boss went into the cloud, and so he had to dive below it because you can't see it. But to get down, he put the air brakes out. And the air brakes of the Vulcan, it's just one big fence, just come chunk. And what happens then? He says, the plane slows up. Well, if you do that without telling anybody.
Yeah, the one behind. There's
two behind in this case. And I came out the bottom, and there's me. And I was within, inches, but because your separation is quite long normally anyway. And if you've got any sense, you would take, if you see you're coming up to cloud, you're not going to be just plowing on. Oh, I'll get a bit closer that I can keep behind him. Not at all. And it was Friday. It's so bad that night I was in bed and he phoned me up. Well, because we didn't meet it after the flight, because he went back to Scampton where he was based, and I went back to Waddington. But they had done this the intermediate year. They'd done this with the full lot, and they flew up Oxford Street instead of the Mall. Yeah, there were funny old times. People are becoming more interested in the Cold War, and Michael, my son, said the Vulcan particularly, because it had that bit of a show off at the Falklands.
Did you ever talk with your crew or with other people about the implications of releasing a nuclear weapon and what the impact was?
I think everyone was very open about it, and no one believed they would actually do it, but if it was necessary, they would, because that's how they're training. But there was no fear that there would be some miscarriage of sending the wrong
code. A mistake or something.
Not a mistake.
Before you were put on Vulcan,
yes.
Did they ask you about your views on nuclear weapons
I'm sure they did. You get... Before you go in the nuclear area, why are all pilots officers? And it's because you handle nuclear secret, and to be handling that material, you've got to be... So you go through from right at the outset, then we know it's not foolproof, is it? I can still see the newspaper leaderboards outside the... paper shop in Wigan High Street when I was about 12, and the McLean and his
Burgess
had legged it, and I'd been that interested in protecting us by the best means possible. And certainly, I think without a doubt, all the people who were flying with nuclear weapons knew that it's, as the deterrent, it's what it is, and the people who malign it or criticize it are undermining the effect of it.
And if you were given the order to drop it, there's no doubt that
that's right. It would just, I think, I say, in my opinion, from that time, there was no one would say no, and they didn't dare say anything like that. No, I don't think there's ever any criticism from aircrew that I know. Yeah. But I don't think there were many gung-ho, boys, not like fighter pilots who really do break the rules because it's only them that they're bothering. Whereas crew of five, big responsibility to each other.
In the Vulcan, it's only the pilot and the co-pilot that have ejector seats.
Yeah, that's right. And because I was brought home in Malta because the guy was just below and slow, hit the ground and it bounced, and then the rover set the fuel on fire, and so the airplane was burning downwind. And they banged out how, fully serviceable airplane, and they killed six people or whatever it was. And I don't know if anybody on the ground, I was quite young at the time, but I know descent and loss of lift. And I used to take them to 8,000 feet over Flamborough Head, clear day, and I say, do a practice approach and put the air brake out. And see, you would be rate of descent 1,000 feet a minute, and that's a breaking approach. And just keep holding that. And suddenly, I mean, thump, you're doing 4,000 feet a minute in no time at all. And that's what happened in Malta. You can you sympathize because they didn't do it on purpose.
This was the incident at Valletta where they came down too quickly, wrecked the undercarriage, took a plant.
It went off again.
By which time the aircraft had,
was on fire. Yeah.
Did the pilot and co-pilot get out of that?
Yeah.
And so the three...
They're both pilots flying and flew on Vulcans again later on.
Right. Did you fly any of the other V-bombers?
No, not at all. No, and of course, a lot of my mates did, but the Valiant never lasted long enough. It crashed in Market Raisin, and that was the end of it. They threw it away. And the other one, the Victor, became a tanker.
Did you do any escape and evasion training?
You mean not...
Like, what if you were shot down?
I was a trainer of that. Mm-hmm. Combat rescue and survival officer did this. And we go on the Dartmoor for 3 or 4 days and a limited amount of support. We also did into the ocean and do things. Yeah, a lot of good training there. So the interrogation is one. And that's one that I was afeard of. So when I did the actual course at Mountbatten, it's on Dartmoor in April, and we were out for a couple of nights, and the weather was absolutely, and really, we were lost. No doubt about it. I saw a glimmer of light, and I headed for it. Seven of them was together, and there were Boy Scouts cooking up their evening meal in a sort of like a cave almost.
Wow.
Well, we stayed there the night.
I can imagine.
And the staff were so upset, because I suppose we're quite a valuable commodity. And if you Dartmoor on a winter, April night even, heavy rain. And I thought, if you're going to get pneumonia for training, we don't need to bother. And we got people who did do this overkill, like a boxer would want to knock you out, whereas you're only boxing. And I was always a bit modest on my leading, because I'm not lazy. I was a very fit, and I enjoyed it, survival training. That's why I became a survival and training. The qualifications I got, some of these books, when I looked them up the other day, I got things that just a certificate of competence, Waddington, to an airframe. I can do the seats. I'm amazed how neat my writing was there.
So you did the bombing competitions in the US?
They did. That's the one that I attended at Barksdale. Yeah. But they go on at different places. But this was SAC, B-52s, and there's really no competition. The accuracy of the B-52. Yes. But the RAF squadrons have done well, really well. Yeah. But it was a social, not a social than anything else, like a lot of things. But the kids used to say to me, "What are you doing the war, Dad?" And I said, "I kept the peace." I always put that, helped to keep the peace.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.